Hello, this is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Episode 42.
That's right. This is Anna.
This is Shireen.
And we have a wonderful guest on this episode. Shireen, will you please tell them who it is?
I will. It is Raj Desai. He is a Raj delight. And he is great. We talk about his coming into comedy after law school and his role as an Indian American in this crazy old country.
So listen up.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Well, this is the nightly coverage news called Ethnically Ambiguous.
My name is Shireen Yunus.
And I'm...
What?
I'm Hannah.
Hello, this is episode 42? Wow. Uh-oh. We're in our 40s. We've officially...
No. I'm still 39. I'm my mom. No.
She was 39. My mom was perpetually 35.
No, my mom was like always turning 40. It was like, okay, like we can see. Like we have eyes. I saw you dyeing your hair the other day.
Hey, you can go gray early. You never know. But this is episode 42, and this episode, we have a very special guest, Raj Desai!
Yes, thank you for having me.
Applause.
Just make you applaud for yourself. Please applaud for yourself. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
We met because I was booking comedy shows, and I think I just sent you a cold email. Being like, come do my show.
Yeah.
It's Comedy Pass.
That's courageous. Yeah. That's a brave move.
I used to have so much more confidence. You should see me now. I haven't left my house in years.
And I think I probably met you through that. I feel like, because Anna would produce shows and I would take photos at them.
I
probably took photos of you and then sent them to you, because that's what I did, because I was trying so hard for a very long time.
That was a while we were really trying to like make it.
Yeah.
And then someone gave us a podcast, and I'm like, I don't take any calls.
I take no photos.
I have shut down completely.
But then, if you guys have seen my short film Fall, Raj was in the film as the doctor.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. It was a great experience. Yeah.
Is this going to be a spoiler if I say that he tries to put his hand in his mouth?
It's not a spoiler. It's not a spoiler. That was the only thing I told him about the film, about his role before he accepted the role. I was like, I'm doing a short film. You have to play a doctor where you put your fist in your mouth. Are you in? And I'm pretty sure you were just like, yeah, 100%, I'm in. And I'm like, great, you're my man.
Were your agents like, Raj, really think about this?
No, I didn't run it by him. Yeah.
You were like, I don't know, like, what will that make me look like? Will that be typecast?
So if you guys, instead of Googling him, you can just see what he looks like by watching my film. Yeah.
You could Google him as well.
But you don't have to.
No, please don't look him up any further than you need to.
I thought it was a pretty flattering shot of me. I thought it looked okay.
Funny, yeah, there was some humor in there.
You played a doctor. Chops? Did you show your parents, like, look, Range?
I know, it's so funny. Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
look, you thought I wasn't a doctor? Here's the proof.
Yeah, well, I was telling Shireen before that I must have auditioned to play a doctor or scientist.
Like, you've got doctor
20,
vibes.
30 times or something, and you finally
booked the role.
Offer only, though.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, that is nice. You didn't have to audition. You show up, there's like 15 dudes that look exactly like you. You're like, what?
That's the worst. Yeah.
Do you run a tough casting session, Shireen?
Oh my, I should have thought about this harder before going in. But you brought your own lab coat too.
Yes, like, I had it for auditions. Wow. Yeah. It was in my trunk.
I didn't know that before asking you. But when you said that, I was like, I chose right.
Yeah.
That's actually hilarious.
Got to save some money
on my
wardrobe.
I just kept it in my trunk because a few times, I don't really audition anymore, but I would get an audition like that day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would say 50% of my auditions required. A lab coat helped.
I mean, believe it or not. Yeah.
It's like, he's a brown man with glasses? Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Scientist, doctor, nothing else he could be.
Yeah. A pharmacist.
A pharmacist. I forgot that profession in the medical field.
Honestly, if you walked up to me in a pharmacy and I did not know you and you had that coat on, I would literally think you were a pharmacist.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, well, he works here.
Yeah.
You should just do that. Oh, wow.
So tell the people that don't know or aren't familiar with you who you are, what you're about, what you do in this crazy old town.
Yeah. I've been out here since March of 2005. I started doing stand-up. And then I've gotten to comedy writing, so right now I'm writing for Sarah Silverman's show on Hulu.
It's so good. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. So you should check it out. We need the viewers, so it's coming back.
Seriously, I love you, America.
Yes, yeah.
It's really a great show. It's not, you would think it's biased for some reason because it's like, oh, a liberal is making a show about America, but it's so well balanced.
Yes, it has really good balance. Like, you see a lot of different perspectives.
I'm a huge fan of Sarah Silverman, and she does such a good job at being empathetic and kind
for Palestine.
Yeah, she's she's truly one of my favorites right now, just in general, because she's so outspoken on Twitter.
You let her
too.
Know.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, she's
can
also.
Can she be on the show? Can you slip our card to her?
A stepping stone for us.
We're that terrible at this point.
Well, like she's also a great boss and a really nice person.
Oh, that's so nice
to
hear. That makes me really happy. That makes me really happy because I have so much respect for her.
Yeah.
But so you said you moved here in 2005.
Yeah.
Where did you move from?
Well, I had a bit of a different path, I guess, than most comedians. I grew up in Texas. Went to college in Texas, and then I went to law school in Washington, D.C.
Oh, you were on a path.
Mm-hmm.
You were
I finished law school and everything. I practiced for like a year.
I did not know this about you.
Yeah, it's
you
weird.
Took the bar?
Took
it's like
the bar.
Your dark
yeah.
secret.
Yeah,
it's like...
still licensed to practice law in the District of Columbia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wait, so your parents are probably super proud for that, right?
I think they definitely wanted me to either like... become a doctor or a lawyer or go to business school or something. Mm-hmm. So I think they were happy with it, but I didn't, to be honest, I didn't really excel. It's a pretty good law school I went to. I mean, it's, you know.
Please name names.
George Washington Law School.
What?
So.
That's really good.
It's a pretty good school, yeah. And I mean, I got in, obviously, but I did pretty
school?
Poorly. Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah,
so it's
that
one.
Yeah.
It's the main George Washington.
Yeah.
Wait, so
did you say you did poorly?
Yeah, I didn't do that. I didn't really. My heart wasn't in it. It just wasn't.
Oh. So you were. So you.
You know,
so
a good fit.
Do you think you were the whole time, even going up to law school and going to the bar and everything, you were kind of like half-hearted about it, or was there a point where you were like, "I want to do this"?
Well, I didn't want to. I mean, I still haven't. It's so long ago. I mean, I graduated in 2002 from law school. It was a long time ago, but I don't even know if I totally. Know what I thought about it and still think about it. But I mean, it wasn't like I was forced to go to law school by my dad, but he definitely wanted me to choose
something
pressures. Like that.
There, yeah. And,
it's never like a force, but it's like that overarching feeling that if you don't go.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like I honestly think like the ironic part is I feel like if he had let me do what I wanted, which was just like get a normal job and and like I would have been like, oh, the real world is really hard. I'm just gonna go to grad school. I would have done it gladly. But I did it kind of against what I wanted, and
out of
then
this
it was
like weird,
yeah, like
unspoken
obligation. Yeah.
Do you have any older siblings?
I do. I have an older brother. Yeah.
What does he do?
He works in biotech.
Okay. So there was expectations.
I think, you know, I mean, the older I get, the more I understand it. My dad had a very hard life, and he had a lot of, you know, he grew up very poor in a third world country, so he had a lot of fear related to security and all that stuff.
That
so
makes
he
sense,
really
yeah.
wanted it for his kids, and it's not nuts. I mean, I certainly would change a lot of things about him or our relationship in the past, but we get along pretty well now.
I think a lot of immigrant parents are like that. They come here wanting a better life, and they see their children's success as something just so they can be secure. Like it's out of so much love, really.
It's funny. I read that Ta-Nehisi Coates book that he wrote to his son.
So between, good.
Really good book. And it's not like I had that type of experience. I had a pretty comfortable life, to be honest. But I just thought when he was talking about his dad and why he was so strict, and I really understood. It comes from a place of fear that is inculcated from like poverty and all this kind of stuff. And I think my dad was just motivated by like, Yeah, I mean, security was everything for him. And he didn't understand that people who maybe grew up with some security don't crave it as much, right. I guess. I mean, I think the bizarre part is his hard work and sacrifice and all that stuff probably gave me the opportunity to do what I did. It gave me a position where I could, I mean, read for fun. I mean, I don't think my dad ever read for fun. Yeah. I think he just did it for school to advance himself. And, you know, so, like, I don't think he understood it. But I think, I mean, he's really chilled out. He's retired, and he's so different now than he was even, like, 10 years ago. Yeah, in a good way.
Yeah, I know. I was talking about this to someone yesterday, actually, where it's, like, children of very rich people in America are more susceptible to, like, join cults. Because there's just, like, no pressure, so they, like, kind of get caught up in these kind of things. Yeah. I was reading about, like, the Nexum, like, sex cult, and, like, all these rich people's kids are, like, involved in it. And it's like, oh, that's right, because your dad's not sitting there being like, I was attacked by a bull trying to go get milk, which is a real story my father tells me all the time. He got attacked by a bull on the streets of Iran, because you're like, yeah, of course, because what other horrible thing happened to you to get to America to give me this lie.
I was chased by a bull all the way here across the ocean.
Dude, the neighbor's bull attacked me. Do you know how hard my life was? Yikes.
So it's you know, it's a tricky thing. I mean, I still have a lot of guilt related to it. But it's really subsided the older I've gotten.
That's good.
Where are your parents from?
They're both from India. Me and my brother were born in America. But my dad is a chemical engineer, which is why he came here in the 60s and got a master's degree. And then,
good for
and
him.
And then, you know, went back to India, married my mom, and then they came here. And then the plan was to maybe move back to India with us. They had us here, and I wasn't born yet, but I guess with my brother, they did move back, and then my dad didn't like it anymore.
That's exactly what happened to my dad. Like, that's way better exactly in America. What happened with my dad. Yeah,
we were born,
and then he decided to move back, and then the minute he got there, he was like, he built like this amazing house for him and my mom. He's a civil engineer.
Okay, yeah.
And so he built this house, and then the minute he got back, after a few months, he was like, I left for a reason. This place is corrupt. I hate it here. And then he left.
Yeah, it's... I think my mom has a lot more sort of like connection. She would have been happy living there. I think my dad he doesn't even go back.
Right.
I mean, all our family is in the States basically. So it doesn't, I think things like I worked really hard to get this house and a nice car and I'm staying here. I think that's his attitude. I think.
How did you make the transition then into comedy after being a lawyer, I guess, or practicing law?
Yeah, I mean, I will say I wasn't like walking away from. I mean, I had a lawyer job. It was pretty low end civil litigation work, and lawyers would know what that is. It wasn't like I was walking away from anything too special. I wasn't even making that much money. I mean,
but it was still something you had worked for years.
I'd worked for it. It's hard work. I mean, even to get C's in law school, it takes some work. trust me, it takes some work. and the bar exam is hard. It takes work. It is work, and it's very competitive, and people are very ambitious and smart. Everybody, to be honest, when I got to law school, everybody was as smart as me and willing to work as hard as me and more ambitious. So that was a new thing. You know, I just hadn't had that level of competition. And then even when you get a job, people are competitive. So it's a pretty competitive field. I mean, so is showbiz.
Yeah, I also feel like unless you want to go for big law, because the people who go for big law are like just hardcore, and then there's the rest of them who are like.
I mean, there's so many people. I mean, I would never crap on the profession. I mean, even when I was out here, I basically did like legal writing and paralegal. Mm-hmm. That's how I supported myself, which is a huge advantage over a lot of people who have to, you know, be a barista or you know, or whatever, and make less money and that kind of thing. So I you know, my dad was, you know what, my dad was right. He said if you go to law school, you'll never starve, and he was right about that.
So before you left your profession, though, were you interested in comedy? Were you thinking about it?
I was obsessed with it from the time I was a kid. I mean, I grew up at the time during like sort of the 80s stand-up boom, and there was a ton of stand-up on TV on MTV, VH1, A&E. I mean, I watched so much stand-up and loved it and was very curious about it and just had no idea how you get into it at all. And in college, I went to college in San Antonio. There was one comedy club, and they had a couple open mics. And I tried them, and I was actually like pretty decent for someone who'd never done it. And they had me come and do a real show.
Whoa.
And I bombed so hard that I thought, and I had no idea that like everybody bombs. I was like, oh, well, I guess this isn't, I'm not good at this. Yeah, I thought you're supposed to do well every time or something.
Yeah. You got on a booked show?
I did the open mic like 10 times or something. Okay. And then the owner was like, hey, if you want to come do this show on Monday night. And the place was packed. Wow. And it's a sort of a funny story. The comedian, I was about to go on, and then I got bumped for this comedian, this guy named Rick Gutierrez, who's still a very functioning comedian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, San Antonio has a high Latino population, mm-hmm. and the audience was mostly Latino. And he gets up there, and he's just destroyed. He's really blue. You know, you guys maybe know. I'm not that blue, you know, so that's a contrast. And then he was speaking in Spanish for, like, half the set, destroying. And I was like... And my thought in my head was like, oh, this guy, he's setting him up. I'm just going to go up there and knock it down. I had no concept that I was going to be this bizarre contradiction. Right. And they just didn't know what to make of me. Rightfully so. I wasn't even good. But yeah, and I just thought, okay, well, I guess that's it for me in stand-up comedy. I guess I'm done. But, you know, never really shook that desire. And then I think, I mean, I'm old enough where I didn't really have access to podcast or even you know, certainly had access to the internet, but it wasn't that, it was pretty nascent then to like just search for like whatever comedian and be like, how do they become a comedian? You know, so the bizarre part is in law school, I had a Lexis account. I don't know if people know, it was sort of Google before there was Google. And they had literally have like every newspaper article on this thing, and you get it for free if you're a law student. And most places paid like, you know, at that time, like if you were a journalist, you had a Lexis account or a lawyer or whatever. And so I just started like looking up people like Jon Stewart and Conan, whoever, and trying to read like how do they get into comedy. And you know, the story was always the same. They packed up their car and moved to LA or New York. So I was like, okay, I guess I could do that. And I did it. And I just started doing open mics. And
where'd you end up going?
Kept going to LA. LA. Yeah. I left DC, and then I actually went home for like 6 months and just lived with my parents and kind of tried to explain to them what I was doing and why I was doing it, which I think was helpful.
What was their reaction?
I think it was definitely not as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I think they were, I would also say this, I am really not, my parents do not even think I'm funny. So the idea that I would be a comedy writer is insane. There's no reason. I'm not that animated in real life. You know, I'm not even that funny in real life, to be honest. So there's no reason why they should think I'm funny. You know,
neither me or Anna are arguing with you. I think it's just like not agreeing.
Yeah. Really, I mean, some people are a little more, you know, showy or hammy. A lot of comedians. You can see how this person wants to be a performer, but you wouldn't even see it on me. You would think I would be a pharmacist. You know what I mean? So.
We've talked about this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it didn't make any sense to them in that sense. But my brother always got, he always knew I was like really into it. And I think he understood it. And, you know, so he kind of explained it to them a little. And they certainly trusted him. He was doing very well in life and everything. So like, that helped. And then I think they just kind of thought I would come out here and get my ass kicked and
crawl back.
Crawl back, yeah. Which. Like I said, if my dad had let me do it when I was 22, that's exactly what I couldn't have lasted 2 weeks out here.
And who were your like who were the stand-ups you looked up to, or just like comedy writers other than like Jon Stewart? Like you said.
I mean, I loved Late Night with Conan O'Brien. It's probably like one of my favorite things ever in any sort of artistic medium. But I would say the stand-up I probably ripped off them flat out was like, oh, I think I can do what this person is doing and rip them off. The number one was probably Mitch Hedberg, and then Dimitri Martin and Zach Galifianakis. I just kind of thought, I thought stand-ups had to be like either really have really strong views about social and political things, which I do, but I don't do it in my act. I'm not up there being like, you know, you're an idiot if you don't agree with me, or like whatever, like Bill Maher. No, I'm not putting him down, but you know, he's very strong in his views.
We all know what he thinks.
Yeah, kind of exactly. Yeah. And that wasn't for me. And then I didn't think like, bearing your soul about your problems, it was for me because I don't know that my problems are really that interesting. And then storytelling wasn't for me because I have like no good stories. I have like zero good stories. So I think I saw Dimitri Martin doing stand up on Conan O'Brien, and I was like, you know what this guy is doing? I think I could do something like that.
Yeah.
You know, not minus the guitar, but like, you know, and so I just kind of like thought of it that way of like, oh, you don't have to be. And I also felt like a lot of stand-ups had to be high energy. That was some other another stereotype I had. Which is still, you know, a lot of the best stand-ups are high energy, you know, and it's great. You know, I'm not. You can probably tell.
Yeah, I'm sleeping.
Just from listening to me. I mean, so I just felt like, okay, Demetri Martin seems like kind of a nerd.
Yeah.
And is just using his brain to generate abstract jokes. And maybe I could do that, you know. And so I kind of approached it from that angle. And then, you know, I got very into Mitch Hedberg and kind of thought I felt like I could maybe write along those lines. And to some degree, I think I did sort of rip off his style for, everyone's ripping someone off early on.
No one's really original when you think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those were the guys I thought I could do. But I always say, like, to me, I think Chris Rock is maybe the best stand-up of all, I mean, probably the best stand-up of all time.
Highest of energies.
But I could never do what he does, obviously, for a million reasons. But one is just style. He wouldn't be a guy I could look to and go, oh, I
could do that.
You should do like a low energy version. Just repeat everything you say twice.
That's really funny. So as far as like milestones go as in your comedy career, what was one when you were first starting out that you were like, I think I can do this as a career. Like, you know what I mean? Like, whether it was writing or getting a job or booking your first, like, headlining show or something.
I mean, I feel like the nice thing about a stand-up and, I was talking to Blaine Kapach. He's a stand-up and a writer. And
At Midnight Guy.
Yeah. Like, it was 8 years ago or something. We were just it was during the writer's strike, and he wasn't writing on anything. I was like, oh, man, like, what are you doing? He's like, you know, the nice thing about stand-up is I can always go back and do it, and it's always, like, affirming. So I always felt like, in general, with stand-up, you get feedback, you know, from people if you're doing a good job. You get pretty instant feedback. So I felt like pretty early on I was getting feedback from audiences that I had something to offer, you know. And so that was always something. And I always tried to view it as I mean, I saw some interview with Jon Stewart where he was saying, like, you know, my big break wasn't getting on MTV or getting the Daily. My big break was deciding I was going to do it and no matter what. So I tried to view it that way.
I like that. Yeah.
You know, like, my big break was packing my shit up in my car and moving here.
Yeah.
But
I like that. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah. I mean, it is beautiful, but there's a lot of lack of truth. It's also like, you do need a break. I mean,
it's poetic, but
Wait. So I think the first like thing I did, I think early on I got on a couple shows that were sort of notable in LA at that time, but you know, like Comedy Death Ray was one show, and that was, and I did Largo very early on, and that was a big deal to me, you know, and you know, people come to that, like agents and whatever. But then I did Craig Ferguson had a talk show like 10 years ago, and I did that show. So that was.
Did your parents 10 years watch ago? It?
They did, and you know, it's bizarre. I never told them I did stand up. I only told them I wanted to be a writer, hoping they would think I was like trying to write the next Great Gatsby or whatever. I thought they might accept it better if they thought I was writing a novel.
There's always some white lie in there.
Yeah, and they were like, okay. And then so I told my brother, I was like, hey, I'm going to be on this show like tonight. And he was like, okay. He told my parents and they watched it and I think they liked
it. That's so cute.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah.
Then how did you make it your transition to writing though?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, a lot of stand-ups, some stand-ups just get seen by somebody and they go, hey, would you come write for me or try out to write for me or whatever. That wasn't what happened to me. I just submitted to a bunch of shows, like packets and stuff, and had on and off luck. I would get far in the process but not get hired, and then finally got work, and it just kind of
snowballed.
There is a thing to, like, momentum and rhythm and you know, in this business or
probably knowing
general.
Like those people that hired you would help you get people like it's probably all connected in a way, like the network or
that I mean, I still think like a lot of people just hire, they don't really care what you've done before. So I do think that there's some people who, I don't know, I mean, if someone reads like submissions blind, who, they don't know what you've done.
That's actually
but
true,
sometimes I do think definitely you just get hired off your credits or you can get meeting off your credits and go from there, you know.
If you just have a real good packet, someone's like, that's a good writer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's what I did. That's how I got my couple of breaks, you know. But I'm in the variety show writing business, and I still am totally mildly confused as to how and why staffs get put together the way they do. And I've been on them. So, you know, it's sometimes I feel like it's very much like we took the 9 best packets. We had 9 jobs. And then sometimes I feel like it's, well, you know, we didn't really like any of the packets, so we just hired people we knew or had, you know, so it's always a different and, you know, the boss decides it, you know, the person in charge, whether it's the showrunner or the host of it or whatever. So, I mean, even Lorne Michaels is ultimately deciding who gets hired at SNL. Right. I mean, the head writer can say what they think, but, you know, he's going to hire who he wants, you know. Yeah. So.
But even writers have to audition on that show, right?
In person, I don't know. They definitely have to send in packets,
right.
For sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, it's right. You can audition, but sometimes they'll just offer
you a writing
gig.
To hire you as a writer.
Gig.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick commercial break. Wowee! We're back from that commercial break.
I don't know why. I'm trying to act like this is some like special report.
Right.
I got that gist. Yeah. I let you go with it. I kind of liked it. Yeah.
What can I do?
But like for those that aren't familiar, like what a packet is just like a sample of your work, right?
I mean, it sometimes I feel like they've evolved over the years, and I've been doing them for about probably 10 years. I mean, of like sending packets into all kinds of variety shows. And mostly what you're doing is if it's a show that exists on the air, you're almost writing a fake episode of the show.
Okay,
like if you're submitting to the Daily Show, you're going to write a piece that Trevor Noah does at his desk with the visual clips or everything. If you're writing to submit to like Jimmy Fallon's monologue staff, you're going to write 50 jokes in Jimmy Fallon's voice, you know.
Right. You're going to write like lyrics for him to lip sync to.
If you're submitting for a sketch stuff or whatever, you know, new ideas that would be similar to what he does. You know, the idea behind existing shows is to replicate what they do in a way that they could plug you in right away and they wouldn't have to be like, figure out the show. So, but then there's the other world of new shows that start up that often can be a good break for people because they need 10 writers, not one. You know, like if you're submitting for Jimmy Fallon, it's probably just because one writer left and there's one opening, and so you're going to compete with whatever it is, 200 people for one job, whereas like if there's 10 openings on a new show, you're competing, you know, it's a bigger pool. So those shows often, I feel like the packets, sometimes they can be really like general, like just send us 2 pages of jokes and a couple ideas and then anything you want, like a story you have or a play or whatever.
Just so they can get an idea of what your writing is like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or sometimes they ask for clips. If you've done a sketch, send them, you know, a link to your sketch or that you like. You know, obviously, you're supposed to like the sketch you send or whatever. And like, so those kinds of things, you know, can be various. And then I do think a lot of shows that are starting out, I mean, no matter what the host or the people behind it think, they are looking for writers to some degree to help them define the voice, you know, to figure out what it is. So what they want is an idea. I would say the overarching thing of any of these packets, less so for certain shows, like I would say the Daily Show, they're just looking to plug you in and you can write in that shows. But like even Jimmy Fallon, they're looking for an idea on paper where they go, we want to do this on the air.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're looking for. That's what makes a good packet, whether it's super funny or not. You know, like I've submitted for shows that I don't think are that funny, but the goal is to get hired, so you got to write something that they would do.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to convince them
that
to like your idea, you know, and to want to do it, you know. And then some other shows, like, I have heard, like, I want to say, I think pretty sure Conan O'Brien himself said, he's like, well, we often hire people who, they pitch stuff we would never do, but it's just so good.
Because, like, it's out of the box.
Yeah, it's out of the box and weird, or it would be way too expensive to do, but we just love the idea, so we hired the guy, you know, or whatever. So, you know, there is that, too. And then there's the old Know Somebody.
Yeah.
That certainly
I feel like that's,
helps.
I don't know. Maybe I'm incorrect, but I feel like a lot of the time it comes down to that in a lot of circles. Like,
I think in a lot of circles, I think, you know, most staffs, whoever it is, I mean, if you're starting a job, if you're starting an accounting firm, you know, if you could hire a couple people you know that you trust, you're going to do it, you know. Yeah. And so I think most staffs have a couple people the person knows, maybe from a prior job or just from the comedy world. I mean, the worst is if they just hire someone who's like a friend from college or something. Yeah. I haven't really heard of that happening, but I'm sure it has. And then, you know, which makes some sense. Then I feel like they round it out with people they never met. Or sometimes it can be come down to like having a – if you worked on a show that the hiring person really respects, they'll like that. Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, so – and then, I don't know. This is the old Raj Desai showbiz maxim, buzz is more important than talent. So,
you know, you got a lot of buzz.
Put that on your gravestone.
Yeah.
I have a few questions. What was your first official writing gig?
I worked on an Anthony Jeselnik show. He had a show on Comedy Central called The Jeselnik Offensive.
I think I knew that.
And but I think before that I had done freelance stuff that was like somewhat, you know, legitimate or whatever, but you know.
Yeah.
Did you like writing on Jeselnik's show?
Yeah, I did. Him and I knew each other from stand-up. That was a connection in a way. You know, I mean, I had to submit, but we certainly knew each other, and you know, he's liked me as a person and everything. And I mean, we were friends. We weren't like just guys who knew each other. So definitely a connection. I enjoy his voice quite a bit, so it's a challenge, but it is a hard voice to write in. So
interesting. Nicest guy I've ever met.
Yeah. I've heard good things.
Okay, yeah. I always say that. People often ask me, what is he like? I'm like, oh, he's actually super nice.
Yeah, well, I guess because his comedy is very, like, intense. You never
think that. People never think that. Yeah.
But then so kind.
Yeah.
Just to steer the wheel a little bit.
Sure.
As an Indian man in comedy, when you first moved here, did you feel like you were kind of different than everyone else, or were there other Indian men like you and you tried to make yourself different than them, or did you feel like it was
I will say, like, I mean, I've been here since, again, 13 years and like 3 months, and what I have seen is amazing, you know, in a good way. I mean, if I went to an open mic in 2005, if there were 30 people, is 20 white guys, maybe 5 minority men, 1 Indian man, me, and then 5 women or something. Mm-hmm. That was like it. I mean, it was always that way. And if I go to one now, it's, you know, 50% white male, which is fine. I mean, I don't care that there are white males doing comedy. I'm not putting that down. I could care less, but it just is amazing. And I think it's just a changing demographic in general. But I never would have envisioned it. And there's certain things like I just never foresaw, like, I mean, I got to write for the White House Correspondents' Dinner last year, not this last run, but for Hasan Minhaj.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And I just never, if you would have told me that they would have had an Indian person, I would have said, you're crazy. And I've seen, like, I mean, one thing that really blew me away was Aparna Nancherla. You guys, of course, know her. Very funny. You know, I've known her since she moved out here and stuff. And she was a Variety, like, 10-to-watch comedian, like, I don't know, a year or two ago. And I was just like, I mean, I would have said, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. That would never happen. They're just not interested in that.
Right.
So I feel like the business has come a long way, but I don't know. I also feel like, I mean, early on I knew, I mean, another just maybe interesting story is early on, I knew all the Indian. I mean, there was only like 4, so I knew all of them or whatever. You know, you at least knew who they were.
Yeah.
Now I don't even know all of them, which is amazing. Yeah, they're like people I don't know, which is kind of a development. I mean, I was at the Comedy Store like a month ago, and this guy brought. I was like, "There's an Indian guy bringing me. I don't even know who this guy is."
Yeah.
So weird. I mean, I was like, "What is going on?" You know. Yeah. And
that's cool to see, though.
It is. Yeah. It's so different, and I do think like. So I think there's been a lot of good changes and or interesting changes, whether they're, you know, good or bad, it doesn't matter. They're interesting. And but I think early on, I think for me, in terms of a voice, again, I lean more towards like nerdier abstract stuff that you know, Dimitri Martin or whatever some of these guys I like did. So I went in that direction, and I definitely think, I mean, people, so I certainly had an agent once who said, you know, you should do more stuff about your family.
That's what I was going to say. I was like,
that kind of stuff, because that's what people expect from you. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, I can't force it. So
they're like, do an impression of your father.
That, yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, people like, definitely said if you did that, you would have gone further. I had, you know, some people say, you know, if, I mean, I think something I heard and, you know, I think it may, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth to it, that if I was a white guy, or people would have just accepted my voice for what, no one would have said, why are you doing that?
Right.
They would have just said, he's a comedian, you know? But the fact that I had something that stood out about me was, you know, it just made people assume I was going to do that thing.
Right.
Which is good and bad. I don't know. I'm not putting down people who talk about what they look like or their background. I think it's great. It just wasn't something I wanted to do. Yeah. And I don't have anything interesting to say about it, at least in stand-up yet. Maybe someday I will. I thought, I mean, I am like friendly with him, so I guess I'm bragging about it, or maybe biased, but Hasan Minhaj did this special on it. It's unbelievable. That was
Homecoming King. It's amazing.
It's unbelievable, and he really figured out how to express something that I never could figure out how to express. I mean, him and I had very similar upbringings for many reasons, and
I made my parents watch that.
It's unbelievable,
I'm from that town.
Oh, Davis. Yeah. Okay,
that's why it's surreal to me. You're like, he's making like references. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
That's why I was like telling my parents, I'm like, I mean, come on, you guys.
Yeah. I mean, anyone can do it. And I never would have, that's something else I would put on a list of things I never thought people would care about a story like that. I never thought it would be like a really well regarded, I think he won a, what did he win? Like a
something,
Pulitzer
I saw he just,
or something?
He just posted.
Peabody.
Peabody
Award.
That's
I mean,
right.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I just never thought anyone would care. Yeah. Honestly, I just was like, no one would care. If I talked about the way I grew up, which was similar to him, no one would care.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
I think it's interesting though, because I made my parents watch it because I related so much to it. It resonated with me, and I think that's something that happens when you choose. If someone chooses to talk about their culture, they have to do it in a way that I don't know makes sense to them. Like if it makes sense, I mean, I think it's interesting you went in a different direction, because I think a lot of the times, it almost feels like people expect you to do the culture thing. And
I mean, it was, I agree. It wasn't deliberate on my part. Again, it was what I felt like I naturally wanted to do. And
that's fair.
I feel
and
like,
I think it's great.
Yeah. Like, what is wrong with somebody who's the one Indian comedian who wants to do something, you know?
But yeah, that Homecoming King, if you guys haven't seen it, 100% watch it with your parents, with anybody. It's so good. That was the first time I had watched something and I related so strongly to it. Like, I needed my parents to watch it so they could understand a little bit where it was coming from.
You know, so I think all that stuff is like, I never made a deliberate choice to like do a certain voice. It's just what came out of me. Yeah. I mean, whether people like it or not is up to them. You know, I like what I do. I'm not my favorite comedian, but I'm up there. You know, I think I like what I do. I think I would like
anyone,
myself.
Is anyone anyone's favorite comedian? Like, do you think someone
you know,
out there
so,
is like, I'm my favorite?
It's so weird. I've been thinking about that because of all things Kanye West, I think in one of his tweets he said, you should be your biggest fan. And and I think people made fun of him for being like full of himself. I'm like, I don't know. There's a lot of like truth to that. And like, you should like what you do. Whatever, you know, you should like who you are.
Yeah.
And you know, I certainly struggled with liking who I was for years. So I think, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kanye West's statements of recent. No.
You were speaking of Coates earlier. Coates wrote an amazing article about Kanye West.
I didn't read that one yet.
It's
phenomenal. Yeah.
It talks about, I wish I knew the headline off the top of my head, but you look it up. Just look up Coates and then Kanye West. But he's talking about how Kanye West wants to surpass race in the way that Michael Jackson kind of did. He doesn't want to be black or white. He wants to be Kanye West. Michael Jackson was Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Because then if you're white or if you're just not black, a lot of things you do are accepted easier. And he goes into it in a much more eloquent way, but I highly recommend it. And we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but the This Is America video that dropped last week, that's like, I feel like it's almost the way maybe America expects someone who is African American I feel like it's a commentary on race, but other than that, I feel like it was like a retaliation, like Kanye West fucked up, here's this to make up for that.
Yeah.
But if you guys haven't seen that either, go watch it right now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I have no thoughts on any of it.
You don't? Wait, what?
I have no thoughts on Kanye West, and this is America's a cool video, and that's about all I have going.
Yeah. You don't think it was like I thought it was an.
Oh no, it's a huge commentary. Yeah. I'm so tired of everything.
Oh,
culture's over, man. I'm just over it. It's a great video. Season finale of Atlanta. Great.
So fucking good.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I'm demanding Raj watch season two. He's only.
I have, and yeah. I mean, we were talking about the director is Hero Murai is like an.
Yo,
amazing.
He's my fucking hero. I love him so much. Yeah.
He's doing episodes of Barry now.
That's what I heard. Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna check it out for that reason.
Barry?
I haven't, but I heard he was directing. I was like, I'm gonna watch it now because of the director.
I just lose my shit right now. You had one job. This is an Atlanta themed podcast. We are Atlanta. I'm just kidding. Back on track. What would you say your favorite writing gig was? I'm curious what you like to write.
Well,
that's
a good question. I've had like three jobs in a row that have been really kind of dreams come true for other reasons. I mean, I worked on Triumph Insult Comic Dog. Had some specials in 2016, and
that's
I always loved Triumph, and I loved Conan, I was saying earlier.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was a huge deal to be hired by someone like that, and mm-hmm. you know, I had to write the packet and get hired. And then, I would say the White House Correspondents' Dinner was like,
that's amazing. Yeah,
that's pretty legendary.
It was really special because, as I've kind of gone into, I haven't really done anything connected to my background that much, you know, and my editing background or whatever. I've always been hired to write for other people. That's how I made the bulk of my money, or whatever, made a living, and. I wasn't the one doing the jokes, but we certainly wrote in a certain way. And so I was proud to be associated with it and proud to kind of represent like brown people in America and brown comedians.
Cool.
You know, I was really, thrilled that they, you know, had me do it. And it was a very short gig. It's not like it lasts that long, but, you know, it was and it was something my parents had heard of. They hadn't heard of anything else I've worked on.
The White House.
Yeah.
No, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Did Hassan ask you, or how did that process go?
We've known each other for a while, and I just, you know, I think he always liked my joke writing, so I just reached out to him and said, you know, if you need any jokes. And he's like, yeah, for sure. And then we just kind of went from there. His head writer is a guy named Prashant Venkatek. So he was the head writer of that, and I've known him, to be honest, a little better than Hassan. So I've known him for years. Yeah.
Cool.
And, so... They those guys deserve the most, by the way, those two deserve like 90% of the credit for whatever happened. Whether you think it's good or bad, they deserve 90% of the credit. They did the most and worked the hardest and really took it seriously. They really took like
the
opportunity seriously. Yeah. I don't think anybody at that time, including me, I thought nobody would watch. It was just like the president's not there. It's just going to be a big yawn.
Yeah.
And I think those guys kind of felt the same way.
Yeah.
But they said, well, let's try to make it good, you know, this, for many reasons. And, and then people cared. I think people tuned in because the president wasn't there.
Yeah.
And took an interest.
You got to go to it, right?
I did, yeah.
What is the room like? I'm so curious. Like,
it's actually, it's such a, it's at the same place every year. It's the Hilton, Hilton in Washington, D.C. And it's a very inhospitable climate for stand-up comedy. I mean, I've done plenty of stand-up and weird venues. I've, you know, done casinos and colleges and clubs and everything. And
that one takes one of them. The cake.
It doesn't take the cake, but it's up there on the cake rack or whatever. I mean, it's such a weird, it's high ceilings. It's very spread. It's like, you know, I feel like a compact, it's funny. Even like that plate, the Comedy Palace was this Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
That's a great room for comedy. It's low ceilings, tight. If you get 20 people in there, or 50, it's awesome, you know, and like big, high ceilings are never good. And then it's also
a lot of judging faces looking at you.
The crowd is also can be, you know, you worry is like Chris Matthews going to think this is funny. You know, I mean, you know, it's like a real question you have to ask yourself. So, older, you know, a little older, mm-hmm. skews older yeah. than most comedy club audiences. So it's a diff. It was pretty nerve wracking. I mean, I'm sure for him yeah. more than me, but you know, you want the jokes to land, and you yeah. want them. We knew people were going to say it was bad no matter what. People who just didn't
right.
like, you know, maybe Trump supporters.
There's always going to be a hater.
I mean, people were going to hate it, but yeah. you didn't want to give them the excuse of no laughs. On
right.
the tape.
Yeah.
And an audience isn't mic'd, which is bad.
So
it just sounds like.
It can sound like less laughter. It yeah. does sound like less laughter in the room, but if there's enough, it'll at least pick up on.
I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, because, mm. like, you know, if you tape, like, whatever, a Chris Rock special, they're going to mic the audience. Right. It sounds loud, you know?
Yeah.
So they don't mic the audience. And it's just on C-SPAN. Of course, it's yeah. shot like,
yeah. Yeah, like
you know,
crap.
Like some dad is shooting it. You know? So it's you can easily, you know, just for instance, the Michelle Wolf one, which I watched, there were times when it sounded like there weren't laughs, but I would be genuinely curious. There probably
yeah.
were.
This
just didn't get picked up.
There.
You know,
yeah.
it just didn't get picked up. And they don't, yeah. you know, they
That's
do some. They,
yeah.
It is funny to watch that C-SPAN video because it. One thing in stand-up comedy videos always cracks me with those cutaways to people
right.
where, like, the guy's, like, losing it and clapping his hands or whatever.
Except they're just like...
But this is just, like, Wolf Blitzer, like...
Oh, my God.
Cutaways to, like, people like that.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
so funny. It just
like
cracks me up.
Like, old white people?
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
Or what's her yeah. face? Sanders. Huckabee Sanders just, like, shaking her head or something.
Yeah.
But on that note, we will be right back. And we are back with Raj Desai.
We were just talking White House Correspondents' Dinner with
yeah.
our correspondent, Raj Desai.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you go home often to see your parents?
I
actually do quite a bit. Yeah, they're in the same house we grew up in and everything.
Oh, wow.
And I have the older I've gotten, the older they've gotten, the more I try to just go back. Like,
yeah.
Almost every 2-3 months, if I can, for even a weekend. I just think it,
yeah,
you know, makes them feel better.
Do you feel like they're proud of you?
I think so. I think a bigger problem is that my brother's older than me. Neither of us are married. I think they would prefer that.
You guys fucked up.
Almost than even like whatever,
right.
accomplishing stuff at this point. But I think they really... You know what? I've done enough stuff that, like, in this business, that I think my dad actually does quite enjoy bragging about me. And
aww.
You know what? It's I don't mind it.
I always imagine like what our parents say, like when they talk about us to their friends or something. They're probably just like, yeah, my son, he's a comedian, or he writes for this, or he wrote for the White. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Like, it's just it's cute to imagine them. Behind closed doors or just to their friends when you're not around. Because I feel like when you're around, they're a little bit more critical. You know what I mean? And I feel like...
Oh, I mean, they're hypercritical. I mean, my mom is more of a sweet lady. My dad is... I mean, he's never said anything nice to my face, I don't think.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's
maybe
what
once.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I don't know.
That's such a funny realization.
No, I mean, I realized it years ago, trust me. But, but he actually... I think he, like, probably the nicest thing, he would never say anything direct, but I got nominated for an Emmy, and then he was pretty impressed with that.
Oh, that's cool. Nice. Wait, what was your nomination for?
For Triumph, writing on Triumph. We got
nice.
Nominated for comedy writing, yeah. So he was pretty into that.
That's dope.
It's also something he'd heard of. Not Triumph, but Emmys.
Yeah.
Right. So he'd heard of that, and that's like
what is this word?
Yeah.
It sounds familiar. Must
He's like,
good.
I love Triumph.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Out of all the things.
Yeah. And I think, like, the criticism thing is, I think it's definitely cultural. I think they
yeah.
think they're helping.
Mm-hmm.
I think they think, like, if nobody, the world isn't going to, my
yeah.
view in general, I'm not a parent or anything, but, like, I feel like my dad's view is the world is a hard place, so I need to make his life hard so
yeah.
he understands it.
Toughen
Very tough
up.
Love.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is one way to do it. I guess my feeling was like maybe the world is really hard, so there should be one place where it isn't suck, I mean,
yeah.
or whatever. You're not like feeling bad about yourself or whatever. But I guess he didn't take that approach. So
rarely do immigrant parents do that.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. And I will say, like, I've seen a lot of people in my family who grew up in similar, you know, strict households, and well, it worked. A lot of them became doctors or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to say for it. I'm not saying everyone is thrilled with it, but...
I mean,
it worked, and
yeah.
then like, and it's. I actually heard you guys know the guy Preet Bharara. He's like he was the U.S.
I've
attorney,
heard the name.
And so he's
oh yeah yeah
He's a big on. He's you know, big on Twitter and stuff. So he's
actually I follow him.
Yeah, yeah, and so he's, you know, Indian guy, and he did really well in school, and so does his older brother. And he said that he's noticed that with his kids, it was really interesting because, you know, he's like having kids who are second generation born here, and he would kind of try to do what his parents did, and they just, the kids were just like, no, like, you're not, I don't care about this B I got on the spelling test. I mean, if I got a B on a spelling test,
oh man,
I never got a B because the concept of it was like, I'm
absurd.
Not gonna, an
A minus was like whatever. Tears.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I just thought that was so funny, and I feel like I think the way I grew up, if I had kids, and, you know, maybe someday, I think I would just let them get away with murder.
Yeah,
I don't know that I have it in me to be like.
Well, because, like, I mean, for your friend, he doesn't have the excuse, like, do you know what it took to get to this country?
Yeah.
It's like, you know what I mean? Like, he can't make his kids work hard.
Like, do you know how hard it was for me to build my Twitter following?
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I
you
know.
Have no respect for
know,
this. This is what I've brought you into this world.
Yeah.
Just like, shut up, mom.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I, you know, it's, I think, like, most people I know, the older that were first generation, the older they got and the older parents got, the better. I feel like, I really enjoy talking to my dad, and it used to be dread, you know. You know, it wasn't fun, and now I think he's really, you know, calmed down.
He's softened
a lot.
With age, I think, a little
it's
bit.
Totally softened with age, and I think I see things way more from his perspective, too, in general. And
yeah.
He, you know, and he did the best he could, and you know, he didn't have the tools to.
I think a lot of immigrant children have a difficult time with either one or both of their parents. And then the older you get, the more you come to understand. I mean, I can relate to that, too. I mean, I think Anna can as well. Just butting heads with your parents for years and years and years.
Still dealing with it.
Yeah. Mm. And maybe part of it is because we're pursuing, like, creative field where our siblings, like, are excelling at, like, what they were supposed to do or, quote, supposed to do. But I think that when you have a little bit more perspective and you see that your parents are just really trying their best.
They're trying their best, and like they just don't. I don't think my dad knew any better, and he only knew what he knew. And you know, it's just I also think like one of the big differences between me and my dad is that, you know, he grew up like legitimately third world poor, and I did not, and that just creates a different worldview. I mean, it just does, and he. He never let go of that worldview because that was his childhood, and so I understand it, you know, and get it. But
when you were growing up, you didn't even think
of course
it that
not.
Way.
Yeah. Of course, you don't have the self awareness to do it, or so.
Yeah, but it's cool when you get older. Hopefully, this happens to most people, but I think parents become more supportive when they see you, if not excelling at what you're doing, at least coming into yourself, you know, because.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I will also speak for at some point they just give up.
Yeah.
I mean, at some point they just go, well, this is what he's going to do. I mean, I can't do anything about it.
I'm
so I might
him,
as well
so.
Be nice to him, you know. And then the other thing that happens, at least in my like sort of extended family or extended network of is like there's some other kid who did, you know, maybe got into drugs, did something even dumber. And they're like, well, at least he's not that guy.
Yeah.
So there is that too.
My parents are in the process of giving up right now. Like you can just hear it in their voices, just like, okay.
Yeah, you know, it's hard. I mean, I think they like did their best. It's such a weird field to go into. It's so opaque. I don't even totally understand it, and I've had some success in it. It's such a, you know. Whatever, like, I wrote on Sarah's show, and then there was, like, a break, and my parents were like, so you're just going to be unemployed? I'm like, well, no, but it's coming back.
Yeah.
You know, so they have no concept
that's
normal.
Too,
you know, so, you know, I think, like, they just don't get it unless you're punching in and punching out, and that's okay. You know, it's not the end of the world. And I think it's – what's funny is my brother took a path that would be very well regarded by – he's certainly, you know, someone who would – people would think – did a great job as like this first generation immigrant and everything. And I think he would say some of the same shit I'm saying, like they were always on my back. They never let up. And
especially
so
if he's older, right?
He's older, they get it worse.
Yeah.
In some ways.
You have to be the perfect child, the oldest one. My sister ended up doing exactly what she was supposed to do. She is a doctor now. She has a significant other that is like kind of converted already to Islam. Okay. Like she's following the path that was put in front of her to a T.
Yeah.
And then there's me. So I feel like my parents, I was just on the phone with my dad before I got here, and he was, and I was telling him like, yeah, I'm going to go record the podcast. He was like, I'm so proud of you. And I love your podcast. And in the beginning, Anna knows this, he was critical of the podcast.
He would
call me every episode being like, I don't like
notes.
This. I don't
he was
like
giving
this.
Notes.
Well, but that's cool that he listens to it. You know?
I didn't know he was going to. Yeah. And when I found out, I was like, I shouldn't stop talking about certain things. But I think the more he saw the response of other people, or maybe just like the articles we'd be on, or just like anything that notable that came up, I think he really was like, I'm proud that she's at least, if she's not going to become a doctor or a lawyer, I can't speak for him, but in my mind, it was like, she's at least proud of her culture enough to not throw it away, you know, because I am. Yeah. And I think parents like that. I think they like when you hold on to something that they've given you and like.
Do you want to hear kind of a silly story?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my brakes... I have to get my brakes replaced in my car.
Oh. Right.
And so my dad's in Iran right now. So last night we were like FaceTiming. Because, you know, anytime, if you're a girl.
Yeah.
Anytime, anything someone at a dealership or anywhere says anything to you, you call your dad immediately. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this is what they told me. What's the real? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
And so he's like in Iran giving me info over like FaceTime. Yeah. Like, okay, this is what you're going to want to do. And I'm like, cool. And then I call him back, and I'm like, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. And he's like, okay, do what you have to do. That's like, you know, they're starting to give up. They know that I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. Yeah. And then today, I pitted Toyota against Big O Tires to see who could give me a cheaper price. And then I called and told him, and he was like, oh, I'm so proud of you. That was it. Like, like, price crunching back and forth. And then he was like, oh, yes, that was a very good idea. Yeah. You're learning.
I love it.
I'm becoming you.
Yeah. I love that he recognizes this, like...
Yes, that's what you have to do.
Yeah. You don't take one person's recommendation for it. Like, you keep...
It's like, well, that's not what Big O Tire said to you.
And your dad is just, like, slow clapping in the background.
It's like, yes, you make them feel bad. And it worked. That. They cut down the price because they felt panicked.
The first person you call is your dad.
Yeah, you always call
anywhere.
Dad.
Jiffy Lube, any place you go, you don't care what they say.
Yeah, they're like,
you lose your dad.
Your tire fell off. And you're like, I'll see about that. Like, call your dad. That's like, Dad, I think the tire fell off. That's real. I know. They give you so much hell, and then you just run back like that.
Yeah.
I have one last-ish question for you, depending on if Shireen also... tell me about Reba.
What?
My favorite bits that Rosh does is about Reba. I don't know why, but it's always stuck with me that you're the Reba guy.
People, that seems to be the most notable comedy I do is about Reba McEntire.
I don't know if I've heard your Reba bits.
Maybe not. I mean, it's really not about her or her show. It's about the episode summaries of her show that would appear on Time Warner Cable. And there was a time when I had Time Warner Cable. I just all this free time. I'd read these the episode summaries, and one of them said Reba cooks too much pasta, and that was it. So it was a whole bit about it. It's the episode summaries for TV shows are so funny. I mean, you have to fit an entire theme in like 4 words or something. So one of the funniest ones is, I mean, you guys are pretty young, but this cook, Emerald, you know, this cook, this sort of celebrity chef, he had his own sitcom on NBC in like 2000. And it was like one of the highest testing sitcoms, is the highest testing sitcom in NBC history is apparently true, but it bombed when it came out.
Sophie, our producer, is the only one that knows that you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He goes bam when he does stuff. Anyway. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
And I was like looking at a hard copy of the TV guide, and the episode summary was Emerald is forced to wear a new jacket. And I was like, why? Like, what's going on here? It's like, what happened?
Like, tell me more.
So those episode summaries are so... One time I did that joke, and somebody came up to me, said they worked at CBS, and like, I have to write those. Oh, my God. That was so funny. It's you know, even like on a dumb sitcom, it's hard to make it make sense. Yeah. You know?
Because after a while, you're just trying to get through your day. You're like, I have to wear this stupid jacket.
Yeah.
Oh, that guy.
Oh, yeah. He looks familiar.
Emeril Lagasse. Is that his name? Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He had a big sitcom. Really? I mean, it was apparently... It was the highest testing sitcom in the history of NBC, and it came out and just bombed. Yeah.
Damn. People were like, I love a chef.
Yeah.
I love to see him act.
I hate his new jacket. Yeah.
That's silly.
Yeah. But I'm sure even as a comedy writer, you probably watch, maybe not, but like, do you watch like Reba or anything? And you're like, are you thinking of like potential specs in your head?
I mean, I certainly have written, you know, spec scripts and stuff, but you know what's weird is like, I still watch comedy. I definitely still watch it, but I watch less of it than ever. You know, you're just around it a lot.
Yeah, right.
You see so much stand-up. It's hard to, like, watch it as much. I tend to watch, like, documentaries and dramas and stuff now more than that, or read even.
Yeah.
And it's so weird. I mean, I don't even have cable, and I guess I'm a TV writer.
No one has cable now.
Yeah, I guess so.
Did you watch Wild Wild Country?
I haven't, no.
But
no,
you're
I'm
Indian.
Curious about it. I know.
But aren't you, like, Rajneesh?
Yeah. You're not wearing red today.
Yeah, okay.
I was expecting you to come in your racist. Your like,
I mean, that thing took off. I mean, that's another thing. Yeah. Like, I honestly, like, 10, 20 years ago, I'd be like, no one would care
about
this.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I another thing is, like, I can't believe when I was a kid, there was one Indian restaurant in, like, all of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now there's, like, I can't go anywhere without seeing.
Hey.
Most of them suck. That's how common they are.
Indian food's good, though.
It is in general, but it's like it's overexpanded, and that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any problem with it. It's unbelievable. So.
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Dallas has ruined Indian food.
No, there's some good spots. Yeah.
So can you please go watch Wild Wild Country and let me know all your thoughts? I'm very curious.
Because
so silly.
Yeah.
Wait, but are you curious because he's – because
– No, I just think – well, I mean, sure. Yeah, there's a connection of just seeing, like, brown people and then, like, people, like, worshipping – like, white people worshipping brown people. Because they're like, ooh, spirituality.
Well, like, you were talking about rich people that join a cult, and there is like there was like a Hollywood, like the Hollywood Rajneesh, like at some point, like joined the cult, and there's like these rich Hollywood people that had nothing better to do than like follow this Indian guy.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm more obsessed with the idea of like, wait, but like, what was he even really teaching?
Oh no, yeah, I watched the whole thing, and I still had to look it up after being like, what was
all
he
these
about?
White people being like, well, I mean, he's from India, so he probably knows philosophy.
Namaste, bitch.
I'm just more obsessed with just that, like how you can just honestly, like every time I bring like souvenirs back from Iran, people are like, oh my god.
They put it on their shrine, their altar.
Like, I literally bought that for like a dollar what's compared there. Like, it was on the street.
Yeah.
Like,
totally
it means nothing.
Yeah.
I'm curious your thoughts. So please write up a 10-page email after you watch it. Because there's 10 episodes, so I'm going to need like a page and
page episode.
But I will say, first you got to watch Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, I will.
Best show on television by far is Atlanta.
Yeah.
I am obsessed with that show.
Yeah,
we will need a page summary for each of those as well. All your
one to two pages.
Yeah.
Cite your sources, bibliography attached.
Yeah.
You know what? Just do footnotes.
Yeah. Footnotes
will work. I just give you so much homework. And we will have you back in a month.
Yeah.
To discuss.
To discuss my paper.
Well, I hope you had fun.
It was great. It was great.
This was so cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I've known you for a while, but I feel like I didn't really know the meat of your story, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I guess I don't announce it.
You're not like, hi, I'm Raj, let me start from the beginning.
Well, how can people find you?
You could Google Raj Desai. I'm the number one Raj Desai on the internet.
What are your social handles? That was my way of saying that.
Yeah, I know. Probably on Twitter is it's @_RajDesai. Unfortunately, there was a teenage Raj Desai who beat me.
Fuck that guy.
I know, right? He has like 4 followers.
Oh, he's one of those.
One of those, yeah. But it's _RAJDESAI.
Nice.
Yeah.
And watch I Love You America when it's back.
Yes, please. Yeah, it comes back
in
September.
It's on Hulu, season one.
Season one's on Hulu and it comes back in September. Please watch.
Yeah.
Last cue. What was your favorite bit that you wrote for or worked on for I Love You America, season one?
Oh, I worked on this monologue about nationalism. It was episode 9, and I worked pretty hard on it. And, you know, it was certainly Sarah's impetus and her idea, and I thought it was came out pretty good.
Nice.
I do, funny. Just to reiterate, I love that you work with her and that she's just so nice. That makes me so happy when your people that you like are nice.
Oh, yeah, you know? No, I know what you mean. You don't always want to meet your heroes, but she's actually pretty nice.
You don't want to meet your heroes unless it's Sarah Silverman. Then
I mean, the amount of jerks in comedy is pretty high, unfortunately. So she is not one.
But it's nice because she does have her own set of privileges, but she uses them in such a good way. Like she's very outspoken about Palestine, about just mental illness and everything. That I just have so much respect for that.
Oh yeah, that and like I don't think people always know. I mean, I know because I'm a little older, but she had a really tough breaks in showbiz and showed a lot of determination and bounce back and had a lot of setbacks. I mean, it seems like she's been a star forever, but she had to really fight for it. And at a time when there were very few female comedians, period. So I mean, she's kind of a badass. Yeah.
I feel like growing up, I never saw anyone that looked like me doing comedy or entertainment. Mm-hmm. And she was the person that was closest to that.
It was the closest I could get, even though she was Jewish.
Yeah. And it was like a taboo. But I was a Muslim girl being like, ooh.
Yeah.
But I do really, I admire her so much, especially as someone that, I mean, I've also struggled a lot with depression. And she was very outspoken about that. In her book as well, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I just love her. Yeah. Love her so much.
Okay.
But yeah, keep working with her and make great television.
Yes.
Watch I Love You America, everybody. It's so good. Or America, I Love You. Did I say it backwards?
I Love You America with Sarah Silverman.
There it is.
Full title, yeah. Mm.
Yeah. You can find us on Twitter at ethnicallyamb, A-M-B, on Instagram, ethnicallyambig, A-M-B-I-G, and then our website is ethnicallyambiguouspod.com.
Yes.
And we're on Facebook, Ethnically Ambiguous. And go to iTunes or your podcast app, and you can write us a nice little review, and we can read it on the air if you give us 5 stars. Nothing
five
less.
5 stars only. 5 stars only.
Yeah.
We're starting a new program. If you give us less than 5 stars, a Mossad agent shows up to your home. Just kidding. Please don't. Oh, Jesus.
All right. And thank you again for being here, Raj.
Oh, you're
you
welcome.
Are
it was a lot of
fun. Delight. Yeah. Raj Delight.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll never say that again.
Raj Delight. Change your handles
Why not?
To Raj Delight.
Get rid of that underscore, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Shereen, I again. Will you bet that ass?
I'd bet that ass.